everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today, Michael, will you let me know when we get Marilyn up on the air? Today, I want to be presenting to you a special guest. Oh, good. Thank you. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi.
There you are. Hi there. My special guest is a very dear old friend. Well, gee, we've known each other a long time now, haven't we? It's been a quarter of a century. Who has been the original author of Aquarius, The Aquarian Conspiracy. Marilyn Ferguson has written a new book called Aquarius Now. And we're going to hear a little bit from Marilyn today, but it's a teaser. It's a teaser because next Tuesday we have an extended program for the marathon starting at 1 o'clock, and Marilyn will be with us for a good period of time then to really go in depth, in detail, with some of the stuff we're going to talk to you about today. Marilyn, let me start off. I think the basis of it all is radical common sense. Let's start with that, okay?
You know how people often say, why do they call it common sense when it's so uncommon? And or whatever happened to common sense. And actually the original meaning of common sense just meant that which was common to all your senses. In other words, if you were paying attention to what you heard, what you saw, what you felt, that was common sense. And somehow it got in more along the lines of conventional wisdom. The term radical common sense, actually, my associate, Paul Cobay, kept mentioning it, and it didn't dawn on me that he was trying to say, hey, this is an important concept, because it just seemed like part of the conversation. And I realized, well, that's a very potent way of talking about it, because radical, Armand, doesn't mean far out or extreme. It means far in. It means to get to the roots. To get to the roots of a problem. And the other day my cousin was visiting, I hadn't seen him in years, and he said, well, you know, Thoreau wrote, a thousand hack at the branches for one who gets to the roots.
How many people do you know who get to the roots?
Maybe it's partly it's because we're sort of somehow because of the pressures and because of habits, cultural habits and so on, we tend to live on the surface. And we do tend to too often believe what we're told, and we don't think things through. But an example of radical common sense would be, it's been found that the kids who are at risk for dropping out are likelier to stay in school if they have a really challenging, difficult curriculum. They're not quitting high school because they can't do the work. They're quitting because they're bored. Radical common sense might see ahead and might have anticipated that in what we did in going to war in Iraq was actually to produce more terrorists. In other words, there are some things where you're on, that was kind of hacking at the branches rather than trying to think our way through to the root. It's more, it takes more time, and it takes that feeling. Do you sometimes, like before an important idea breaks through on you, do you sometimes feel a little discomfort?
Yes, I feel a great discomfort. I feel kind of niggly because I'm waiting and I don't see it and I don't see it and I don't see it.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I'm just looking.
It's a body feeling, isn't it?
Yes, it is a body feeling.
And then there is this relief. I remember one time a body worker, you know Stuart Heller.
Sure, sure, Stuart.
He said, I think that people, conceptual people, are better at getting body work than body people. Because when they get a concept, their whole body can change. And somehow I think maybe it's the body politic, that we need to be more questioning, and we need to learn to be uncomfortable, to be comfortable with not knowing, or to be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
With not knowing, you know? I mean, now there's a concept for you. You mean, but aren't we supposed to know everything?
Haven't you noticed the more you know, the less you know?
You mean there are some people who would honestly say, I don't know anything. And
well, I've noticed that I've spent 20-something years interviewing eminent scientists and less eminent scientists about their research. And what I noticed is that the more profound and creative and original the researcher was, the more mystified they were by everything. It's like they were in awe of what they were learning. They were not smart alecks. People who are smart rather than intelligent, I think, are, you know, we all get to that place on the spectrum of our function. You know, sometimes we're just too smart for our own good and not intelligent enough.
Well, you know, you're one of the pioneers. I remember a meeting we had somewhere, I guess it was on the West Coast, wasn't it? With the Great Science Fair where you had...
Oh, the Mad Scientist and Artist Party, Tea Party.
The Mad Scientist and Artist Tea Party, which you had, and you had invited a number of people.
Yes.
Name some of the folks who were there.
Gene Roddenberry.
Mm-hmm.
He had hoped it was going to be a smaller group, but we didn't stay for too long. Arthur Young, the great...
physicist.
Well, he invented the Bell helicopter, for one thing, and Carl Prebrum, who introduced the idea of reality as a hologram, and Tom Robbins, the novelist, and it was a really great...
And Ted Turner was there, I think. Was Prince Charles there?
Nope, Chuck wasn't there.
Right. But
I fondly think of him as Chuck. I've actually never met him.
Well, you know, it was a meeting, and I was lucky to be invited, or I must have been in the neighborhoods, therefore I got an invite.
I remember, Armand, because you would probably not remember or be too modest to say so, that Arthur Young presented you with the Mad Scientist Award.
Right. Right. I do remember. I treasure it. But what I remember about you having a concept of MSU, and I think MSU is a very important concept. For all the scientists, it's like if you had all these people who were the best-known minds at that time in the world gathered together, Marilyn would have them wearing a T-shirt, and the T-shirt would say MSU. What's MSU about?
Well, my former husband, Ray Gottlieb, and I, one evening, we were ballroom dancing in our living room, which sounds kind of strange, and he said to me, what's creativity? Which was just kind of a rhetorical question because he's a very creative guy. And I said, without thinking, making stuff up. He said, making stuff up, MSU, the new institution of higher learning. And so we had those sweatshirts printed. People thought it was Michigan State University, Montana, and so on, Minnesota. And I know this sounds a little bit like a paradox because I said also about not knowing. But I think that the making stuff up is what Stuart sometimes, he said in terms of new ideas, that you can have an experimental belief. You don't have to burn your bridges. Just try an idea on for size. That, you know, if you look around your house, your office, your car, wherever you are, and you realize somebody designed this, somebody came up with that idea for the carpet if you're in a building or for the design of the car, and everywhere you look around you, all that stuff was MSU'd. Somebody made it all up. Why not you? We somehow accept that we're, and maybe that's part of the consumer mentality, but I think that just that sort of simple, unthreatening notion of making stuff up can help people, like whatever sets you free. Whatever sets you free, it's going to usually be some kind of simple thing and basic, almost mundane notion because, you know, nobody is in the ringing the bell tower and saying, the British are coming. This is, you know, whatever war we think we're conducting for our freedom isn't here. And maybe we need to think more like the Founding Fathers. But I think that we liberate ourselves, not necessarily through acts of civil disobedience, or certainly not through violence, but every day thinking for ourselves. Every day, not being afraid to be, you know what people call eccentric? It's kind of interesting because it just means it's off the center of what they would do or what most people would do. But we all have our own center. And I think the people that we call eccentric are maybe just coming from their own center, and they're unselfconscious, and there's something really appealing about that. There's something appealing about people not caring what you think about them.
Yes, there's something very appealing about the people who don't care about what you think about them, because they're allowing themselves to think. It doesn't mean you have to be a rebel or you have to be out there slapping people in the face saying, look at me. But the person who stands up there with the T-shirt and says, let's make it up together. Let's figure this out. Let's look at it. What are the difficulties? What are the things you run into? I mean, judgment is such a hard thing. It's so hard to not take sides. How do you look at today's political environment? How do you take a look at what's going on in this world? How do you take a look at where we are in that political environment and look at it and appreciate it with some sense of being okay with the understanding? Otherwise, you just tear your heart out. I mean, do you sit there?
Yes, I know what you mean. And for a moment there, I'm thinking, well, I suppose I shouldn't comment on anything political. But then I remembered that political just means power, and everything is political.
Now, let's comment on political.
Okay, because I think that in a crazy kind of way, we needed this. We needed an example of a kind of absolute monarch. Because I say so, thing to happen in our government to wake us up, because we were not going to get there little by little, that what could have been more unifying in some ways than this sense of, hey, they can't do that. Hey, wait a minute, now they did this, now they did that. You know, because one way or another, Armand, we can't live with it. I mean, we're going to have to solve it one way or another, and how it's all going to unfold, I don't know. But I think it's certainly going to make better citizens of us all.
So you think today's political environment was created by a need by all of us to get past the kind of small, can't really touch it, these little power things that are going on all over the world, and you couldn't look at it, and somebody came along and said, the hell with it. Let's show you what the whole thing is like. Here's the whole enchilada.
And we get to, in a sense, if we weren't around in the revolution, who knows, we get to see what that was like. For those of us who wondered how the German people could have given up their say-so little by little, we can see that nobody said anything. Do you remember there's a, I believe it was Martin Niemöller, the Lutheran theologian, who said after World War II, when they came for the gypsies, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a gypsy. When they came for the Catholics, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a Catholic. When they came for the Jews, I didn't say anything. And when they came for me, there was nobody left to say anything. That it's important to see how you can lose your sense of having potency little by little. And I think we do that in relationships, don't you?
Yes.
Sometimes you don't realize that years pass and you go, oh, my God, what's happened to me?
I gave that away. Okay, I don't do that anymore. And I gave up my sports, and I gave up my friends, and I gave up my everything, and I gave up my curiosity.
And all of that in the name of getting along.
All of that.
Being polite. You know, we don't want to be rude. I watch C-SPAN a lot, and I really recommend watching C-SPAN because somebody wrote a column the other day in the L.A. Times and said that you don't really get what's going on in the news by just watching the newscast. You really need to have a sustained, pure period like watching C-SPAN. And I admire the civility of the people in the government and in the legislature, pretty much the civility. And I think it's a necessary thing. But I'm also reminded that we sometimes just get too timid in the name of good manners, and we don't speak up. It's kind of like when you were in school, and the teachers are talking about something, and you don't get it. Finally, somebody, with more balls than anybody else's. See, you know, I don't understand. And the whole class breathed a sigh of relief because nobody understood, but they didn't have the guts to say so.
Well, speaking with Marilyn Ferguson, dear old friend Marilyn.
Yeah.
Yeah, dear old
friend. We've had some good times.
We've had some
good insights together.
Yes,
I quote you often.
You know, you talk about migration, that our history is the story of our migration.
Mm-hmm.
And we're running out of frontiers. Tell me about that.
Well, what I said, the place I started from in the book was that the whole story of humanity is the story of migration. That we just crisscrossed this planet forever. We were trying to get away from, you know, warring neighbors. We were looking for better land, better water, you know, more room, whatever. And so there's always been, I called it the rumored land. It's kind of like the promised land, but it was the rumored land. But all of the reasons that human beings ever had to migrate, we have now. You know, we need a cleaner place. We need to get away from hostility. We need clear water. And where is there to go? We can't do that anymore. And so what I propose is that what we still have to migrate, and we have to migrate to a new understanding. Because there's only so much give in the, you know, there's certain things about our world that are finite. And it doesn't mean that we're all that limited and we have to do without and it's going to be really rough from here, you know, like the best has already happened. But that we need to come at everything from a different, and more poignant, more understanding point of view. And I think that the tsunami, Katrina, fires, the tornadoes, the earthquake in Pakistan, that all of that forced us to have a fairly sustained period of not being able not to look at suffering of our fellow human beings.
I'm going to say that again slowly. Not being able to not look at the suffering, right? We couldn't look away.
I think it changes us.
Well, it's kind of funny. You know, we have a war where we can look away because we're not allowed to see.
Yes.
You see, we're not allowed to see even the coffins coming back.
Uh-huh.
Or the dismembered soldiers. We can't see that. We're not allowed to. But they it's perfectly okay for you to see what happens with the tsunami and with New Orleans and all that stuff. So it was with Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like Earth was saying to us, you cannot deny us the vision of the people who are suffering. You can't deny this. You must see it.
That's right. And I think it was necessary for people to feel that sense of shock and almost frustration, feeling helpless. And this time, unlike what happened after September 11th, when people wanted to do something and the only thing they could think to do was donate blood or buy a little flag, this time, I think it was important because for all these people watching TV from all around the world, particularly in our own country, they didn't show up. The famous them that's supposed to take care of everything didn't show up. You know, there's always been that kind of like comfort zone between ourselves and having to deal out what was necessary in a crisis that the government was supposed to do it or some other. But it didn't happen. And I have a feeling that many of those people who just picked up and put the stuff in trucks and gathered things and drove to the Gulf region, I think that many of those people had never done anything like that in their lives. But for the first time they saw, oh my God, something is needed. And they realized they could do it.
I watched it during 9/11 here in New York. I watched people gather and move to do something because for once they went beyond what they were told. They went beyond the barriers. They said, no, there are people who need help. And they moved and that thing finally clicked in. You know, whereas we're constantly told that whatever we have to offer is too small or meaningless. There are times that you can't.
And if there are any experts on hand, they don't want you coming around. You know, leave this in the hands of the professionals.
The head of FEMA, for example.
Right. You'll just get in the way. And so, as as sad as it was. And another thing I think was wonderful that was really positive was the media people got angry. They let their humanity come through. I think that most people are troubled by that sort of artificial something that's there in the anchors and the reporting, and it's not quite real. It's like everything that they say is, they're thinking, what would we think and what would we want to know? And all of a sudden, they were pissed off. They could see that they were being given a runaround, and they were openly angry.
Well, some of them actually became reporters as opposed to being representatives of the corporations they worked for.
Right.
Some of them actually stopped and said, wait a minute, this is wrong. Why isn't the helicopter stopping? Why isn't there some help going on? Many of whom have lost their jobs now and then. You know, there's been a significant number of people who are no longer there, those who reported on Katrina especially. You know, but I think it's important. I think what you said is important. What happened to the reporters, you know? What happened to the people who would tell us what's happening in the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that some people were concerned that we wouldn't see that again, that it was just a fluke. But I saw op-ed pieces and other pieces of writing where they were, it was one of those, you know, we will not forget things for a lot of, we will not forget.
You know, Marilyn, we're going to talk much more about this when you're back with us next Tuesday.
I look forward to it.
But, you know, before you do, I want to bring back one old memory. Let's talk about World War IV. World War III and World War IV, yes.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about it. What was that concept?
Well, my friend and your friend Fred Lehrman lives in Seattle when he's not traveling the world. He got this idea at my house in L.A. It was a holiday. It was the day that Passover and Good Friday happened on the same day, and people were coming and going. And I can't remember how. He remembered that the year before, after the seminar, we did something in New York. You remember on D-Day?
Sure.
He decided it was Dragon Day, that he'd always wondered about the dragon, and he decided the dragon was us, as in the Chinese parade. So the next year, on this particular day, he said, thought about D-Day. He said, what do we do to commemorate D-Day? And then he said, how come nobody ever asked the people what kind of war they'd like to have? And immediately I saw this as an event. What kind of war would we like? And we came up with this idea. It would be a war on the causes of war. And it would be a ritual that should be original to every group that participated and not designed by us, but that we would collectively on Hiroshima Day, which was August 6th and 7th, at the time of the bombing of Hiroshima, that we would all over, and it turned out to be all over the world, we would do whatever it was to acknowledge the tragedy of war. The theme was from Sean O'Casey, the Irish playwright, the bells of the earth have tolled long enough for death. Let them now ring out for life. As I recall, you all in New York had a big circle in Central Park and passed the peace pipe and compelled some Japanese tourists to join you. And the same thing happened at the state capitol in St. Paul, Minnesota. There were people on Mauna Loa, Mauna Kea, Mount Shasta, and in the Himalayas. At the site of Gandhi's assassination, at Martin Luther King's assassination, it was really great. It was kind of designed to be self-propagating with no headquarters. And we've been thinking about maybe it's time to do a bigger version of that, if it doesn't scare people. Some people were disturbed by our use of the word war. And by the way, you may remember it was called World War IV because
World War IV, right.
It was doing an end run around World War III. If we already had World War IV, it was too late for World War III, which during the Cold War was always on our minds. And, you know, obviously there is, you know, we certainly didn't eradicate war. We may not have even made a dent in it, but I think in our own consciousness, we had a sense of having expressed an important truth that the opposite of war isn't peace, it's creativity.
And I remember at the time, it was such a movement. So many people joined together. It was fantastic. I remember we even broadcast it. We had it on a radio as well. And Isaac Hayes, wasn't it, who made a song for us?
It was Lionel Richie.
Lionel Richie. I thought it was Isaac Hayes.
And people made professional radio announcements. And I still meet people who, they said, I was with a group of people, Jews and Lebanese on the border between Lebanon and Israel. We did it, and the people where the film The Day After was made, they did it. And but I think you and I both have a healthy respect for ritual.
Yes, we do. But, you know, I have this thing about you being back with your book now, and I know how much time it's taken you to complete this work. I think it's time that we have some kind of an effort together, and I think we can call on it, and I think we can make it happen.
I think so.
Some of the minds have been missing, and many of them are numb at this point. Many of them just feel like they want to close themselves off and just be isolated.
Well, I think a lot of people are just waiting for a signal.
Just waiting for a signal. Marilyn, thank you for being with us. We're going to be with you next Tuesday. This is my teaser. Marilyn Ferguson, author of the book Aquarius Now, Radical Common Sense, Reclaiming Our Personal Sovereignty. Book just came out. It's great to be talking to you, Marilyn. We'll be back with you.
See you on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, see you on Valentine's Day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. She brings tears to my eyes. She's great. Great. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, my friends, a tiny bit of music. And we'll be taking a lot of calls from you people as well. Back in a few minutes.
We are Soweto Gospel Choir. Zumba, 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 zumba. And you are listening to BAI New York. BAI New York. San Bonani.
Back in time. That's Midnight Express, my friend. Armand DeMille here with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Fabulous. Marilyn Ferguson is back. Marilyn Ferguson, author of the Aquarius Now. I mean, Marilyn said something very important there. Maybe we're waiting for a signal. You know, maybe we're waiting. There's got to be a person who stands up there and says, okay, now. And it's like almost all of a sudden all of us will stand up, you know, and we'll say, okay, that's it. Now, what's going to make it happen? It used to make it happen. You know, I mean, a station like WBAI used to make it happen. A march on Washington used to make it happen. A protest, the war made it happen. But slowly, slowly, they have done to us, a little at a time, our minds have been dismantled. And they've been dismantled slowly so that we could be, we are now inactive. Well, one of the places that keep you active is WBAI, radio station WBAI, our station here. Starting tomorrow, we're going to be actively involved in our fund drive, bringing you information and bringing you some thinking about homeland insecurity, about what's happened with homeland security and how it's affected us. So this fund drive should be bringing you a lot of great information. Be sure to tune in and make a note to yourself to next Tuesday. I will be doing a long program from 1 to 4 p.m. with Marilyn Ferguson and other people addressing the issue of paranoia versus reality. Here's a question for you. You know, I mean, what happens? When are you paranoid or when is your fear real? And what happens with something like Homeland Security when we have this oppressive government? What does it do to the fragile minds? What does it do to a mind that's not fragile? What does it do to a mind that is fragile? Did you ever notice if you suddenly have an outburst or if you have an explosion, some people are going to jump through the roof when they hear an explosion, and other people are going to look over their shoulder and say, what was that? Different people have different sensitivities. People will respond not in one way, but in many different ways, and part of what my job is to help you understand the different responses from many different people. Some people become passive. Some people become angry. Some people's anger is in itself pathological. Some people's anger doesn't just mean they're justified in being angry. Sometimes the anger is based on something in the past and not based on the present. Sometimes the suppression of anger is crazy. Sometimes its expression is inappropriate, and sometimes it's appropriate, and sometimes it's effective. What we want to do is understand. Understand humans, understand people, and don't get mad at people. Just don't get mad at them. Understand them first. Let me tell you a story about this. This is very interesting. I want to talk to you about sundowner syndrome. Sundowner's syndrome. Did you ever hear of such a thing? Look at that confused face in the studio with me today. John Alamanidis, who is my assistant, and she's saying, I'm confused. What do you mean, boss? Sundowner syndrome. It all started with a guy named Lou. I live in a building, and it's an apartment building, and suddenly every evening, somewhere around 6 o'clock, Lou would be downstairs saying, why is it dark? Why is it dark? Well, this would go on, and this has gone on for the last year, and there were some attendants in the building, and he'd be talking to them, and it turns out he was down there till 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, couldn't understand why it's dark. He's a reasonable man. I've known him many, many years. But he's confused. And so I went on the internet and looked up light, dark confusion. When does somebody get confused? And of course, I had seen other things happening with him, showing signs that his mind was deteriorating. And they came up with a thing called sundowner syndrome. Sundowner syndrome, it happens with certain people with dementia, which means you're kind of a neurological mental disorder that happens to older people, happens to other people as well. And that what happens with this is that a person loses their interpretation of light and dark. Their mind doesn't work. And it particularly gives them a fear of shadows. Now get this. Sundowner syndrome. What happens at sundown? Mostly shadows, right? So they leave their homes and they go looking for the light. Now these are people who could be perfectly reasonable for the rest of the time, but when sundown comes in, they're not reasonable anymore. They are afraid of shadows. Now, imagine if you are somebody who's got a survival mechanism in your body, and that part of the way you survived is you know that if somebody's going to jump at you from the side, you're going to run away, or you're going to defend yourself. You have a mechanism inside you that says, watch out for things that are moving. If you're walking down the street and you see something moving real fast, you wonder to yourself, should I duck? Am I going to have to deal with this? In sundowner syndrome, you lose the ability to perceive the shadow until it's too late. So the body automatically gets you to defend yourself against the shadow, and it gets you to seek out the light. Now, this is such a far-out thing. Here I am looking at it, and there were a whole building full of people who were confused by this man's actions. So then it goes a step further. Because a person who cleaned this guy's house said, his house has a terrible smell, and the refrigerator is filled with food, and you couldn't get people in there. He didn't want anybody to come in. We tried to send in social services. He would not allow them in. He threatened to sue anybody who invaded, and that's his right. There is a thing called anosmia. Asnosmia? It's either asnosmia or anosmia. I think it's asnosmia. Asnosmia, anosmia, that's it, anosmia, is the inability to smell. In certain people who have this kind of dementia, what happens is you lose your sense of smell. Now, your sense of smell, you may say, whoa, that's like when you get a cold. It's really dangerous, because when you don't have a sense of smell, you could eat rotten food. You could eat bad things. Your sense of smell protects you from eating bad foods. You need your sense of smell. It's one of your defenses. When your body realizes that you've lost your sense of smell, it gets punchy. More punchy, and you get more frightened and more paranoid. Now, you don't have a sense of smell. You can't sense the shadows anymore. Your body wants you to stay alive. It's trying to give you defenses. What defense do you think you're going to get? Well, if you were an animal who lost its primary defenses, who couldn't see any longer and couldn't smell, what are you going to do if you think you're in danger? You're going to roar. You're going to yell. You're going to howl. You're going to hope to keep people away because you want them to think you're a big animal. Well, that's what the guy in the building does. He goes around screaming at everybody. And everybody wonders, why is he so angry? But he's so angry because he's got this dementia. And the reason that he's so angry is because he's roaring. He's roaring so that he could remember he's a lion. Now, what do you do when you roar? A little further research into psychology, and the reason I think it's so wonderful to know this stuff. When a person who has Alzheimer's or dementia becomes very angry and fights you and does things that are dangerous to themselves, how do you handle them? There's a real question. One of the problems is, you know, most people who have got Alzheimer's can live from 8 to 30 years after they have the disease, so their death is not imminent. Very often, the mate of the person who's got Alzheimer's dies before them because the mate suffers such tremendous stress. So much stress because, you know, you've looked at somebody who you've loved who's become a baby and become angry and accusatory and paranoid all the time, and you live with it morning, noon, and night. The middle of the night, they're always waking up. They can't sleep. They're wandering around the house. You're trying to keep them safe so you can't sleep. It's like sometimes they tie themselves to the other person with a rope so they'll know if they move. And you live like that because you once loved this person, but surely you begin to hate them. Surely you get angry, and it irritates you and irritates you. And the ones who die are the mates. And, of course, the person with the illness is not a bad person. They have an illness. Well, what do you think you do? Now, what happens? What's the highest rate of incident of death? Well, and pardon me for those of you who are experts in this. I'm just, you know, an amateur, but here's what I've learned so far. 50% of the deaths of people who have Alzheimer's are caused by wandering. What is wandering? Wandering is when you're walking around at night and you're lost. And that's what they tend to do. They tend to sleepwalk. They tend to get up. They tend to go out. You could go out in the middle of the winter in your pajamas and you could freeze to death. You could, of course, get mugged. You could, of course, be, you know, you're lost. You're completely lost. You're walking around. You don't know where you are. And that's what half of the death of these people are. So now let's go back a minute. Now you go back to a building, a Manhattan apartment building, and in the large buildings, I'm told, there's always somebody who's got this syndrome eventually running up and down the building. They're like a, it's like they're a ghost of the building, you know. Somewhere they're going to appear on a floor somewhere, right? If they don't have anyone to take care of them, especially if they live alone and there's nobody there, their family becomes the entire building. Their family becomes, if they have doormen, the doormen. They don't have anybody to take care of them. It's pathetic. It's sad. I feel family with this man who is going through all of this. That's why I did the research to try to see how I could help. Well, what happens is they're angry all the time, right? So now they go out towards leaving the building. And in a way, the man who's attending the building or the doorman or the guard of the building says, no, you shouldn't go out. And, of course, now he's dealt with the violence of this person. He gets angry. He starts screaming at him, you let me out of here because who do you think you are? I will, you know. Now, of course, if you're just an attendant in a building and this is not your family and you have a family that lives somewhere else, part of you wants to open the door to let the guy go out. Go ahead, go out and wander the streets. Why do I want to take that responsibility of keeping you here, especially since you're violent? All right, let's move this, my friends. This is Armand DeMille with you, talking with you about a syndrome that is common, and many of you have had family. Do you have family that went through it?
Alzheimer's.
What?
Alzheimer's.
Yeah, Alzheimer's. It's sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell me who you went through this with.
Armand, my grandmother had Alzheimer's disease, and she outlived my grandfather, who took care of her, who tried to take care of her for about 8 years, and then he became ill. You know, he never wanted to have a home attendant, and he became ill, and then he died. And it was really difficult to watch that.
Difficult to watch her, too, huh?
Yeah.
She not only forgot about you, but she would go through all of these things I'm talking about.
Right, and she became angry at first, but then she came very much like a baby. She's like a child. She's like an infant.
And, you know, we better make room in our own minds for more and more of this appearing, because people are living longer than ever. And taking more chemicals, which I believe is helping them get along to this place where their minds break down, there's more medication. So we better learn how to attend a little better to this, because these are our brothers and sisters who are out there who will be struck, will be walking. This is the new homeless. You know, where they may curb the homeless problem, they've created another syndrome of people who are wandering. Well, about the wanderers, you know, a person is wandering and they're going through the streets. And, of course, let's say we take the scene about the building where the person reaches to the doorman and the doorman says, no, you can't go out. And the person gets angry. What's the solution? And here's the point, my friends. The reason you want to learn about people. When this person confronted me with anger, I learned something from my readings. It said laugh. Laughter detoxes their anger. Well, that's a funny thing. So the person gets angry, and they get really angry at you, and you start to laugh. Well, you know, a funny thing happens. In their mind, the laughter doesn't make sense, but they don't think you're making fun of them. They like laughter. Laughter makes them feel good, and in many cases, laughter completely takes away the anger. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to make a joke. You just have to start laughing. I noticed this because in this one particular building, there's a man who always laughs. He always makes jokes. And he always detoxes the guy who's the angry guy. Science. Think about some of the homes where many people, you know, who are in one of these assisted livings or in this a home, and they're in a home, and they have, there's a lot of people maybe wandering around with this kind of syndrome, and what do you have? You have attendants who are making jokes at their expense. hey, you're trailing toilet paper behind you, and they laugh at the person, and everybody else laughs at the person, and you say, what humiliating treatment. What a terrible thing to do. How could you talk to people like that? But they laugh, too, because the laughter feels good. So, an exciting story, don't you think? Exciting because what you could learn about the human mind, and there are so many different things that are available to learn, it doesn't take it far. There are many people who don't want to get online and they don't want to do the research. A lot of people who don't want to understand. There are people who tell me, oh, I don't want the scientific understanding of the human mind. I don't want you to break down love into compulsions. I don't want to understand. I want to believe that it is whatever I believe, that people are bad. And the bad people should be done away with, and then there are people that are good, and the good people should be made saints. And that's what people want to believe. I'm sorry. They're not bad. And they're not good. They're people. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Starting tomorrow starts the fun drive. Roberta Atti will be here. We'll be doing a program, and we'll address the issue of the fun drive. But, you know, we just got a couple of more minutes, and I'd love to take some of your calls. I'd love to be able to hear from you, hear your responses, say hello. I want to report. So our telephone number is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. A reminder to you, the interview with Marilyn Ferguson that we did a little earlier, it will be available on the Internet at WBAI.org. I heard they've been having some trouble with their streaming. You can't get it through them. You can get it through my website, thepositivemind.org. It'll take a couple of days for us to get it up there. But Tom Gerbe, G-E-R-B-E, out in Long Island, is our master guy. He's been doing the job. Remarkable. Remarkable. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand.
Hi there.
This is Edward.
Hello, Edward. Edward, how nice to hear from you.
Thanks a lot for your radio show. Thanks, it's great.
Thank you.
I didn't hear all. I came in a little late today listening to the woman with the book.
Yes, Marilyn Ferguson.
I just really called to say hi.
Well, Edward, I want to thank you very much for saying hi. In answer to your question that you asked me in email, yes, you're always welcomed.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sure. Thanks for calling in. 212-209-2900. In answer to our survey that we did a survey, and we asked you all, if you haven't responded to it, maybe you want to respond to it now. I asked, which of the formats do you prefer when I do the program with you? Do you prefer that I do the program completely alone with no callers, completely alone with callers, with a co-host like Roberta Barriotti, who's with me on Wednesdays, or without a co-host? And how do you kind of see it? Do you like the calls? Do you not like the calls? And do you like the music or not like the music? Here's what the majority of people said. They said they love the mixture. They love it when it's all me one day, taking callers the next day, Roberta Maria the next day. They like this. They like having that, guests sometimes and guests not other times, you know. They like the mixture of it. They like the newness. They like that they can't predict exactly what's going to happen. And most of them love the callers, except for one thing. They don't like the callers who just linger on for a long time, who I show a lot of respect to. But, you know, with callers, I don't want to screen them. Because one of the things we could do is screen the caller, find what they call, quote, a good caller, and have them on the air. I don't want to do that. I want to show you how to deal with people no matter who they are. So our survey kind of indicated keep everything the way it is, with a couple of people who really said, no, change it. I dislike this part, and I don't listen to you on these days if you're doing this stuff. Okay. Thank you for your opinions. If you want to send me that feedback, I'll still take it, Armand at Brainlink, BRAINLINK.com, because I'm always learning. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, I must say it's very much an interesting topic, and, you know, it just moved me to want to ask you a question as to what made you came up with the decision on this topic this afternoon.
Which topic?
In terms of the young lady lecture.
Marilyn Ferguson, okay.
Yes.
Marilyn Ferguson is somebody I've known for about 25 years. She just sent me her book, and I was so excited to get it. When I read about it, I said, this is perfect. I'm going to put this on as a teaser today, a teaser so that next week we'll do a full program on her. She's just a remarkable person who has been a leader.
Yes, I must agree, sir, because I tell you, I fall very much in sync with pretty much what she was saying, you know, and I can't wait. I'm pretty much anxious to hear what she has to say when you do hear that program next week.
Good. Well, we will. Thank you. Thank you very much. Ryan, 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Armand DeMille, hi, you're on the air. Hello there. 212-209-2900. We got time for one more call, I think. There it is. Hello there. Hi.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Well, that was a quick hello. I'm sorry about the sometimes, you know, just I hold you on for so long it gets difficult for you to know. You got to stand by. 212-209-2900. Last call. Hi, this is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand. So it's interesting about Alzheimer's. Now it seems cool that if you enjoy making fun of people who are senile, you could rest assured that they enjoy it too. It sounds like such a neat rationalization for making fun of people. Now, life just got better. If you enjoy it, rest assured they enjoy it too.
And thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's making fun of people, but I think it is laughing. I think it is trying to say your anger is not real. And I don't treat your anger as real, and I'm not going to respond to your anger with anger, which is what people tend to do. So I know that your heart needs laughter. And if your heart needs laughter and it makes you feel happy on the inside, I'm going to give it to you. That's what I think it is. Well, that's it, my friends. We're going to have to be going. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with Roberta Maria Atti and the kickoff of our marathon, which I look forward to. Be sure to plan yourself to be around here a lot. It's going to be very exciting. If you need a copy of today's program, I told you, you can go to the website WBAI.org or thepositivemind.com. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Bye-bye for now.